cup fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Found the way downstairs and drank a cup, and looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat, made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke, and somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, James Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, the author of a new book on the administration, the life and the death of JFK, entitled JFK and the Unspeakable. And I just want everyone to know that as much research as I've done on this subject, I have yet to find a book that is better than the book by the author I'm privileged to have as my guest today. Jim, it's a real honor to have you here on the show.
Thank you, Jim. It's an honor to be with you.
I must ask how you, a bit about your background and how you spent your life and how you got involved in research on John F. Kennedy.
Well, I'm a peace and justice activist and a writer secondarily. My wife, Shelley, and I have a Catholic worker house, a house of hospitality for homeless families here in Birmingham, Alabama, deep in the South. I grew up in British Columbia, Canada. I'm a dual citizen, born of American parents on the other side of the border, so by place of birth, I'm Canadian. By parents, I'm American. And I've I began many years ago trying to be a nuclear physicist at the University of California in Berkeley, and dropped out of that, didn't believe in what I was doing, and looked for something more meaningful, and was in the Army for a while. This was between Vietnam and Korea, between Korea and Vietnam in terms of chronology, and then I went to Santa Clara University, majored in English, and then was at University of Kansas, University of Notre Dame, then over in Rome, Italy, studying and theology. And for the rest of my life, I've been either teaching, which I did on campuses at Bellarmine College in Louisville, Kentucky, University of Hawaii, and University of Notre Dame. And then I've been a peace and justice activist and a writer, writing books on the theology of nonviolence, until I began work on John F. Kennedy, which was about 12 years ago. So for the last 12 years, I've worked on the Kennedy book.
Well, I got to say, Jim, that this this book of yours is so thoroughly researched, and I'll comment on some of the relatively obscure figures you talk about here that have done such excellent work and in which you have drawn upon. But you also have a gift for writing. I mean, it's just utterly engrossing, and you say so much, and it's so clear, and it's so accessible. I mean, it's just, for example, when I started reading your book about, you know, JFK when he was in the South Pacific with PT-109 and all that, my goodness, I mean, you just made it so much come alive in relatively brief compass. I mean, your book could have been 1,000 pages long, it seems to me, but you have actually put it together in half of that length, and in fact a lot of that is your notes, because they're very extensive. So the actual text is about, well, not quite around 400 pages.
But you
write wonderfully. I just got to say, I have encountered few authors whose writing was such a pleasure to read.
Well, I have to say that that's rewriting. I'm not instinctively a great writer at all, or even a good writer. I just have to rewrite everything about 30 times, and that's why it's taken so long. And also the research, which, as you know very well from your work, takes much longer than the actual writing. So it's a very, very slow process.
This is very interesting. Your styles as an author and mine are almost opposite. My first book, which was on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, I typed out from first page to last. It ran about 500 pages, completely sequentially. When I took out the first page, I mean, I had done a lot of minor edits, and it was covered with snowpack, which was very popular in those days. This is like around 1980, and I mean, when I said it to the publisher, they didn't ask me to change a comma. And I was just, it was no doubt the greatest intellectual feat of my life, but it was just, knowing the subject so well, and it had a rather intricate structure, but I knew exactly what I wanted to say. And yet there's that sense, as I'm sure you have felt, of when you get into a certain point in a book, there are ways in which it just develops itself. Of course, I was dealing with, the theory of science, and there was a lot of structure to it and a lot of arguments where it was fairly amazing to me how effortlessly it came. But rewriting has only occurred to me in the era of the computer. It's only since I began writing on computers that I would, put together drafts, paragraphs, go back, edit them, change and move them around. And it's really altered my writing style.
Well, to take a further step into honesty or concrete description, the way I understood or have understood the process is actually the way Gandhi calls his autobiography. He calls it a story of my experiments with truth. And as I said in the introduction or the preface, that I tried to do it, the story of JFK, as an experiment in truth, and that is to go as deeply into that unspeakable reality as possible without regard to the consequences, without regard to where it might end up. And it's been simultaneous with trying to understand the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, all four, but JFK chronologically is the first. But I understand it primarily not so much as writing a book as an experiment in truth, and that works better because a great deal of the time is spent in either interviewing people or doing research from the National Archives or in just trying to understand the implications and the next step in the process, and then how to tell the story, which is quite different in order to make it comprehensible and interesting to the reader. That's quite different from how I find something myself. So that's kind of the process, what Gandhi would call an experiment with truth.
Well, you've done such a masterful job. I mean, just an illustration of people who are extremely good but not well known to the public. Your book is dedicated to Vince Salandria and Marty Schatz. And I mean, these are really interesting guys and very significant in their own right, but they're also very obscure to most Americans. They would never have heard either of those names. How did you come to know Vince and Marty?
Well, I first encountered Marty's book. I had heard of Vince because he's, as you know, one of the pioneers in assassination research, and I don't think I'd heard of Marty, but I encountered his book when I was relatively new in the process, which was in the mid to late 90s, and I recommended it to a friend, and she called him up, and she was interested in getting the book. She couldn't find it, and he said, "Well, where did you find it out about it?" And she said, "Jim Douglas," and so he phoned me. And then I was invited into a symposium by mail of Vince Salandria and a group of correspondents, which was my seminar in understanding the Kennedy assassination for 3 or 4 years. Every month they would share, all these people, about a dozen or so, would share articles or insights that relate somehow to the Kennedy assassination. So I just went through graduate school in the Kennedy and JFK research during that time.
Where were you physically situated?
I was in Birmingham, Alabama. I've been here since 1989, But, of course, Vince is in Philadelphia, and Marty Schatz is up in the Boston area. And the other people were all over the country. And I didn't physically meet any of them until I went to a conference in Dallas in the late 90s, and I met Vince and Marty, and I've only seen them, a handful of times since then. Not really that. I've only seen Vince Landria once in my whole life.
Well, that's very, very interesting. Vince, of course, was extremely active as a first-generation investigator of the assassination.
Right.
And made a lot of important contributions. The book by Marty you're talking about, of course, is entitled History Will Not Absolve Us.
Yeah.
Marty happens to be a psychiatrist,
yeah,
which may give him a certain fix on, the way in which minds process information, because
yeah,
I think, the most telling point he makes is when he observes that in relation to the disinformation movement, those who don't want to confront the truth about JFK for any number of reasons, that their objective is to leave us in a situation where everything is believable and nothing is knowable.
Exactly.
And I've encountered so much of this, Jim, myself in the research I've been doing, especially with David Mantic and Bob Livingston and Jack White and John Costella and so forth, because
yeah,
there's a group out there who will attack anything we do. They're absolutely unrelenting. They will never grant a single point that we make, and it's become increasingly obvious to me over the years, and I've been dealing with these people for a decade and a half approximately, that their objective is precisely to create a sense that things aren't really known, that they aren't certain, that we can't be confident that we actually understand what happened. And that's a lot easier objective than, say, convincing somebody that an account like the official Warren report is true. It's a very different matter.
That's right. And I didn't try really to argue with any of these good folks who take that point of view. I only had one objective in terms of writing the story in the context of that experiment in truth, and that was to tell the story so that people could understand it. So it's not primarily, it's only secondarily an investigation of the Kennedy assassination. It's primarily to tell the story of the turning or the change of John Kennedy, as the subtitle of the book says, why he died and why it matters. It's the why. So
yes,
the why in story form. And I'm not primarily concerned, as you probably observed, with the angle of the shots or those kinds of minutiae of evidence. And the witnesses are witnesses to the story, and each of them has his or her own story that is parallel to John Kennedy's story, and what happens to those witnesses is also parallel in many cases to what happens to John Kennedy. So it's to tell the story. That's the whole point.
Well, it's a fascinating book and extremely complementary to the work that I have done with those I just mentioned, because we've been focusing on the medical evidence, the ballistics, how the execution,
yes,
how it was carried out and how it was covered up.
Yes.
And so much of our attention is focused on reconstructing the case from the ground up, going back to the autopsy x-rays, the autopsy report and so forth, and assessing its adequacy, because when I first came into the case, Jim, I was simply astonished by the vast quantity of evidence, but it was all...
Yeah.
It was all conflicting. It was incoherent.
Yeah.
On any issue, you could find, contradictory witnesses or reports or even photographs. And it became apparent to me right off the bat that the crucial problem that confronted research in this area was sorting out the authentic from the inauthentic. And,
exactly,
and I have been fortunate that, the first person I reached out to with respect to collaborating, and I was at that point proposing that we joined together on a long article or a book was this man David W. Maddick, who has both a PhD in physics from Wisconsin, an MD from Michigan, and he's board certified in radiation oncology, which means, of course, he makes professional decisions that affect the life or death of his patients based upon his, among other considerations, an analysis of their x-rays. So this guy was uniquely positioned to go into the National Archives and study the autopsy x-rays. I remember a conversation we had. This was in late 1992, before he made his first entry, that he thought he would find evidence of a second shot to the head.
Mm-hmm.
And but he said he also thought he'd find evidence that the x-rays had been altered. And I said, David, I said, either way, we have what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And indeed, he found both.
Yeah.
Because there's this trail of metallic particles that comes from the, you know, a frangible or exploding bullet that entered JFK's right temple, and it's very distinct there. But also he discovered that at the back of the head, this massive defect, and you talk about it as being the size of your fist, which is exactly how Chuck Crenshaw described it to me. He said it was the size of a baseball, by which I took him in a hardball, or he said the size of your fist when you double it up. And it was this huge defect, but which had been patched. It had been covered up, it had been concealed, and David was able to apply a simple technique, which you describe, of course, in the book, optical densitometry, that enables you to measure the amount of light that passes through an x-ray, and on that basis calculate the relative density of the objects whose exposure to radiation created the image. And he discovered that they'd used material that was much too dense to be human bone, so that whereas we had, you know, various diagrams, there's the Robert McClellan diagram of this blowout to the back of the head. I had asked Chuck Crenshaw, who was one of the physicians who was present the day that JFK was brought to Parkland, and then 2 days later was responsible for treating his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, to draw diagrams of the wounds for me. And he drew, of course, this massive blow up to the back of the head and gave me that vivid description. But it occurred to me, Jim, you know, this is such a simple thing to do. There were about a dozen physicians there at Parkland Hospital who could have been asked to draw the wounds they observed on the president. And yet, to the best of my knowledge, McClellan, and who approved of a sketch, and Crenshaw, who actually drew one for me, those are the only two I know of who actually drew those things. And yet, they're so telling that when you have that kind of information. And, of course, go ahead.
Yes. When one gets into that, it becomes clearer and clearer that the conflicts come from the ways in which the evidence was gathered. And as you know, when you talk with Mantic or with Crenshaw, who have the courage or the integrity to speak the truth, and when one goes to the sources of the information, the huge conflicts begin to evaporate. They have a lot to do with the way the evidence was gathered, or rather ignored and covered up.
That's right. Just to offer an illustration in relation to my second edited collection, where I brought experts on different aspects of the case together in each of my three books on the death of JFK. The second, Murder in Dealey Plaza, begins with 16 smoking guns, where I, you know, illustrate 16 devastating points that really refute major aspects of the Warren Report and demonstrate that it's hopelessly inaccurate and misleading. And a friend of mine, when the book first appeared, was going to the dentist office, and he was reading the book, and there was a little old lady there who noticed he was reading, and when he went in for his dental treatment, she asked if she could look at the book. And when he came back out, and he was there about an hour, when she handed the book back to him, she said, "You know, it's also very simple once you understand the evidence." You know, I mean, she'd read the 16 smoking guns,
She
already had this tremendous insight from about the case, and it's therefore been my concern that, you know, everyone, all Americans, should understand the case this well. In fact, every resident of the world, because this was among the most admired and loved human beings of our lifetime.
That's right. And so I think that trying to make an entry into his his life can help us in that way, because we can begin to see the story in terms of a person and a few other persons who are key to this too, including the witnesses, rather than only the evidence that has been so intentionally made obscure or made conflicting by the people who deliberately did not want us to understand it. So if we can begin to get into Kennedy's story and see why he was being killed, then it all begins to become it becomes
right.
more it becomes more and more obvious, and the intentionality of the cover-up becomes quite fruitless if one understands clearly what was going on in the White House and among the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Central Intelligence Agency and so forth.
Yes.
It becomes so obvious that it would be strange if Kennedy were not assassinated.
Well, I think you do this magnificent job of developing, tracing the history of his emergence as a visionary, as a true statesman, as a man who really was envisioning a world at peace. And, of course, in the United States, especially when so many powerful factions are driven by power motives or profit motives and don't have a vested interest in peace because it won't make them money or strengthen their control over whoever for whatever reason, that there was an inevitable tension that would emerge. And, of course, as you're suggesting, it came from several powerful directions, including the CIA, with which Jack was disillusioned by the Bay of Pigs, where they'd been so massively misled. Jim, I don't recall, I didn't recall if you noted it, but actually the CIA admitted that the Russians had learned the date of the invasion about 3 weeks in advance, and Castro knew when the landing was going to take place. But they didn't tell JFK.
That's right, and the Bay of Pigs is, I think, the first obvious conflict that Kennedy has. But there are actually times before that, in fact, reaching all the way back to his time meeting with President Eisenhower days before he becomes president. Already, he's beginning to get into a major conflict.
Yeah, because what was Eisenhower telling him? I'm looking for the passage.
Yeah, Eisenhower was telling him that in regard to Laos, that he definitely should not accept any kind of a negotiated settlement. And Kennedy had raised that question, which was an heretical question to raise with Eisenhower, and he knew it was, but he wanted to probe a little bit. And as soon as he became president, then he's beginning a different direction on Laos, so that before the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy is already listening to his Laotian ambassador, who had a different view of things than the official line, and he's already charting his own independent direction of a negotiated settlement and communist representation within a coalition government. So this is way before the Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs just makes more obvious because he makes such a seriously wrong decision there and is being manipulated by the CIA, and then he makes this extraordinary statement, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. That's when the break becomes very, very obvious.
That's one of the few times, too, I think, when Jack showed his hand, which was probably an unwise thing to do. For the most part,
yes,
as you depict it, he's being very, cunning is the wrong word, but be very thoughtful in the way in which he's receiving and processing the information he's getting, the advice he's receiving, and so forth, without revealing his own thought process. And this, of course, becomes especially apparent when he's having to navigate the treacherous shoals of the 17 days and the, you know, all the threat of having Soviet missiles in Cuba and so forth when the world came to the brink of a nuclear holocaust. And it's also fascinating, too, how much the chiefs of staff were supporting the idea that the United States should launch what was really a preventative attack against the Soviet Union, a massive all-out nuclear missile strike, and that they felt that the waning days of 1963 was the last opportunity they would have where they could do this in a way that, in their opinion, would leave acceptable losses on the American side, which, as I recall, is in the vicinity of 13 million dead, and we were going to inflict, 100 million dead on the Soviets. It was these preposterous figures, but they were taking it seriously.
That's right, and I was astonished to find such detailed confirmation of those meetings, thanks to the JFK Records Act and to the records of those meetings with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and with all of Kennedy's intelligence advisors. They're very, very detailed confirmations of those meetings, and even from different points of view. So I think that provides, as much as anything else, the context of the JFK assassination. And then, as you say, the calendar that was moving forward, where they saw their last opportunities in terms of a disarming first strike and of winning, as they would put it, hardly anybody else would put it, lose 13 million people and you win because you kill 100 million people.
Yes.
Nevertheless, that's the kind of insanity that was driving the Joint Chiefs and the CIA. They thought it's absolute good versus absolute evil. It's nuclear weapons, ours versus theirs, and we have to strike before they get enough to begin to move up toward our advantage. So long as the U.S. had the advantage, they had to take advantage of that advantage, and the last opportunity was in the fall of 1963. So the greater purpose, even greater purpose from their standpoint than killing John Kennedy, was to strike in a disarming first strike both Cuba and the Soviet Union and win the Cold War. And very fortunately, even though they succeeded in assassinating Kennedy, they did not succeed in taking that further step of striking first in a nuclear war.
That's right. In fact, Lyndon played a crucial role in relation to the assassination, and I think that as Oliver Stone, for example, portrayed, he was very supportive of giving the generals their war, in this case in Vietnam, where they were disillusioned with Jack, not only because he hadn't invaded Cuba against their unanimous recommendation, he'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviets against their unanimous opposition.
That's
and
right.
Now, of course, he was going to pull our forces out of Vietnam, where they felt a stand had to be taken against international godless communism. And as James Bamford portrays in his book Body of Secrets in relation to Operation Northwoods, it's rather apparent that the chiefs had gone off the deep end, that they were actually paranoid here, and that they were obsessed with defeating communism and taking any measure necessary to do so, including fabricating evidence to implicate Castro in attacks against the United States that were classic false flag operations.
Yes, Operation Northwoods, all of which I cite, the entire document I cited in the book, as you say, provides a good context and understanding what Kennedy was up against, so that in rejecting that false flag operation in which the Joint Chiefs were going to create a false scenario in order to justify the attack on Cuba, and justified even by the killing of U.S. citizens, that provides a kind of window to see just how desperate they were to win at any cost. And Kennedy, of course, rejected any such operation.
We'll come back to this point, Jim. We're going to take a brief break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. We'll be right back.
son, I say it's all right.
Assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's you.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. We were talking about Operation Northwoods, and indeed, Jim, you do discuss it, and it's in, you know, around pages 96, 98, 99, and so forth, and there's a paragraph here that seems to me to be quite striking and encapsulates in many ways the broader themes of your work on JFK and the history of his growth and development in his administration, which I'll read for the benefit of our listeners. What is unrecognized about JFK's presidency, which then makes his assassination a false mystery, is that he was locked in a struggle with his national security state. That state had higher values than obedience to the orders of a president who wanted peace. The defeat of communism was number one. As JFK sought an alternative to victory or defeat in a world of nuclear weapons, he became increasingly isolated in his own government. He had been freed from the demonizing theology of the Cold War by the grace of his deepening relationship to his enemy Khrushchev. At the same time, he was forced to realize that, in his own administration, he was becoming more and more isolated. His isolation grew as he rejected his military advisor's most creatively destructive proposals on how to win the Cold War.
Wonderful. I think you've hit on there the key in many ways to understanding JFK and his turn toward peace, and that is his relationship with his enemy, his primary enemy, and also another enemy, namely Nikita Khrushchev, and then secondarily Fidel Castro. In Kennedy's relationship with Khrushchev, we can see all the seeds of his own change. His secret correspondence with Khrushchev is a revelation of all of that. And just to read, for example, that first letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy that was sent in the fall of 1961, and then to read Kennedy's response to Khrushchev in his secret letter, and to realize that Khrushchev is smuggled into the president in a newspaper so as to go below all the normal national security channels and the observation of any media, all of that, to realize that these people are beginning to talk to each other. That's very unusual. And then the very symbol that Khrushchev suggests to Kennedy for their relationship, the atheist, the communist Khrushchev, pulls one out of the Bible. He says, you know, it's as if we're on Noah's Ark and we're in the sea of nuclear weapons, and Mr. President, let's not have an argument over who are the clean and the unclean on this boat. Let's realize that we've got to keep the boat afloat. And Kennedy comes back in his first letter, also written from beside the sea, beside an ocean that he loves, just as Khrushchev was writing, and he says, yes, that's right. Let's go with this symbol of Noah's Ark. And from that point on, they are struggling, they are arguing, but they are talking to each other and doing so in secret and establishing more trust in each other than eventually they have in their own national security advisors. And that total turnaround occurs in the midst of the most critical moment in human history, and that is at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy realizes, of course, that he's losing control of the whole situation. The Joint Chiefs are doing everything they can to either trick the Soviet Union into a move that can become a justification for attack, or somehow pushing Kennedy into his own attack. And Kennedy sends to the Soviet representative in D.C. a secret message from Robert Kennedy, from himself through Robert Kennedy. I need your help. I need your help. And then the wire is sent to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev turns to his foreign minister and says, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And at that moment, everything turns upside down. And then Khrushchev repeats, as we know from his son Sergei, that he says, we now have a common cause. We have to stop those pushing us toward war. And that's the point at which everything changes. Everything changes.
Well, I think
we're only catching up to that in these days, thanks to the revelations that have come about through our documents and the JFK Records Act.
Well, I think you do a brilliant job of conveying an understanding of how, at the time of the assassination, two humans, perhaps those most powerfully affected by his death, were Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev.
That's right.
I mean, they were devastated. Khrushchev couldn't talk for days.
Right.
It's just stunning. And then Jackie, you know, tells the Russian ambassador how Jack and Khrushchev were trying to work toward peace together, but now Khrushchev will have to do it on his own.
That's right. And Castro, who is receiving at the very moment when JFK is shot in Dallas, a representative whom JFK has enlisted as a means of beginning an actual dialogue with Castro, he's meeting. Jean Daniel is actually meeting and having lunch with Castro and beginning that dialogue when the phone call comes that JFK has been shot, and then a few minutes later that he has been killed. And then Fidel Castro stands up and he says, everything has changed now. Everything is going to change. And
yes,
that's the end. Even though he tries in many ways to begin a dialogue with the successor, Lyndon Johnson, that goes nowhere. And Jean Daniel writes the story of those meetings with Fidel Castro in the New Republic in the next couple of weeks, but people don't pay any attention to it. And I was astonished that all of these key meetings between Daniel, this Paris correspondent, reporter, and Kennedy, and then Castro. It's all out there within a couple of weeks of the assassination, and it's as if it's not there because nobody wants to go there. Nobody wants to understand that Kennedy was moving in a totally opposite direction from his national security state, and that is the reason why he is killed.
Well, you know, a book that you don't mention in your references, and which I actually believe is a work of disinformation, but which can nevertheless be used to reveal truths. You'll recall how Dan Rather was discredited by offering a report that he'd actually verified with a secretary who had typed it about Bush's commanding officer when he was in the Air National Guard, considering him to be derelict and unsuited for duty, and yet they discovered that the typewriter on which, you know, that had been used hadn't existed at the time of the document's origination. And, of course, that was a clever deception, because what it meant was they retyped it using a typewriter that was more modern, with a deliberate intent that if the public understands that this is a fake document, they'll assume that the content cannot be true, when in fact, you know, nothing could be more different. Now, a fellow named Gregory Douglas published a book a few years ago called Regicide, talking about the assassination. And in this case, he claimed to have English translations of Russian documents, the Russian study of the assassination. And as soon as I read, you know, what he was purporting to be the Russian documents, it was obvious to me that this was a work of disinformation, because the Russian portrayal of the assassination was the same three-shot scenario that we got from the Warren Commission, which is far removed from the truth. Jack himself was hit four different times, Connally anywhere from one to three, another shot missed and injured a distant bystander, a couple other shots missed. I mean, there were 8, 9, or 10 shots fired from six different locations, Jim, and for the Russians couldn't possibly have done their own investigation and have come up with the same conclusion as the Warren Commission. So this was clearly a fabricated document, but yet what it had in it was a discussion about how the CIA, and in particular James Jesus Angleton, who, you know, was the counter-espionage, brilliant guy, but who'd also gone off the deep end, had become paranoid that someone was leaking information at the highest level to our enemies, the Soviets. So he prepared different versions of the same document that had just enough subtleties that he would be able to detect who had been responsible for the leak, because he was giving the high administration officials different versions, and he was astonished to discover that it was Jack who was leaking to Khrushchev. And according to Gregory Douglas's discussion, you know, this was a precipitating incident in leading Angleton to enlist the chiefs and the CIA and others to take Jack out. But I happen to believe that, you know, in works like this, you can get these deeply embedded truths that are going to be discounted because other parts of the book don't look right, just as the typewriter was the wrong typewriter, and yet the secretary had confirmed that that was the memorandum she had typed. So Dan Rather was actually on impeccable grounds, but the Bush people had pulled this brilliant stunt to discredit him.
That's right. The disinformation and the cover-up and the creation of false trails is part of the most fascinating material in the John Kennedy assassination. But it's also the kind of material in which we can become so engrossed that we never get to the heart of it. And I tried to avoid those kinds of trails in order to avoid writing a 5,000-page book, for example.
And also
to keep to the actual story, to the actual story of what was happening with Kennedy. But there have been so many false trails created that it's a labyrinth, as
That's what something I admire about your book. I mean, we've had to deal with all of this because, you can't untangle what happened on 22 November 1963 in Dealey Plaza without having to cope with all of that. But it's a
That's right.
messy, contentious business. It requires a great deal of special kinds of expertise that are not commonplace. So that some of those who actually are trying to defeat the advances we're making in understanding want to even, you know, kind of in a wholesale way dismiss areas of specialization and technical competence as though those who were who are actually most competent to conduct these investigations were supposed to be the least credible. I mean, it's preposterous, Jim, but it's actually reached that extent.
And in a sense, the disinformation confirms the importance of the why, because first of all, you ask, now why on earth is the government of the United States, in terms of intelligence agencies, you know, this is 2009, it's almost 46 years after the assassination of President Kennedy, why are our intelligence agencies putting enormous effort even today into creating and emphasizing false trails about someone who was killed 46 years ago? Well, if you begin to understand that it's an issue where the President of the United States is killed by his own national security state, there's the reason why it's still important from the standpoint of intelligence agencies and that same national security state priority of making uppermost the military-industrial complex. It's still important to keep us as citizens from understanding the real why of the JFK assassination. It had nothing to do with Marilyn Monroe. It had nothing to do with any of the false stories created about his various efforts in the Cold War. It means, really, that we must not be allowed to understand that this man was turning toward peace, and that's why he was killed.
That's exactly right. And I admire the clarity with which you lay all this out and the thoroughness of your research. It's to me, really a truly impressive book, and I think that you took exactly the right approach to a complicated subject to simply lay it out in as straightforward a fashion as you possibly could, while acknowledging the ways in which Jack was being dealt with in a duplicitous fashion. I mean, think about this Vietnam business involving the Diem brothers, where you have Henry Cabot Lodge as his ambassador, who is very eager to undermine him. Roger Hilsman, who is his purportedly one of his own aides, is not being candid, but actually working against him behind his back. And even McGeorge Bundy seems to me to be playing a crucial role here in undermining and defeating Jack's own strategy. And I was stunned, you know, when reading the meeting where he was talking about whether they should or should not continue to provide AID money, that's the Agency for International Development, which is widely regarded as a CIA operation for funding, you know, political puppets. And Jack was saying, well, maybe we should, you know, discuss this issue about AID money. And the CIA guy says, well, we don't need to debate it because we've already cut it off. And
as you explain
so clearly, that was the signal that the Vietnamese generals were going to interpret as their green light to go forward with a coup, which of course would result in the assassination of both of the brothers, very much contrary to what JFK would have preferred. In fact, the whole thing is such a nasty business.
And as you recall, Kennedy says at that moment, looking at the aide representative, do you realize what you have done?
That's right.
And of course, they do realize what they've done because aide is a CIA front. What they've done is just what you've said. They've sent the green light signal to the generals to go ahead and assassinate ZM, and this is totally contrary and over the head of what Kennedy is trying to do, where he's encouraging Lodge to talk with ZM and get ZM to change his attitude, or he's going to undergo enormous pressures from the people that Kennedy can't trust next to him, including Lodge. So Kennedy is trying to actually negotiate with Lodge to get Lodge to encourage ZM to negotiate, and none of them are going to move, including ZM. So the whole thing is a betrayal of Kennedy.
And as you so beautifully observe, it's also the CIA telling Jack to his face who's really in charge.
Telling him exactly who's in charge as he tries to struggle with what has been done directly contrary to his orders, and he's being told in a barefaced way, it's not you, Mr. President, it's we who are in charge in Vietnam.
There are a lot of despicable players here, Jim. It's really disturbing, you know, and you go back to the Joint Chiefs and the Operation Northwoods and Curtis LeMay, you know, who wanted to bomb the Soviets back into the Stone Age. I mean,
and we even have the tape recorded meeting with JFK and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and LeMay addressing him with total arrogance and saying to JFK what a terrible position he's in, and JFK says, what did you say?
Yeah.
And then he repeats it, and eventually Kennedy rejects totally their contention that he has to invade Cuba, and he walks out of the room, but the tape recorder keeps on recording, so we hear them cursing him out as he's no longer even in the room. We've got all of this material, and yet people who write on these issues totally ignore it.
That's right, and in fact, you know, LeMay is saying that you're in a terrible position, and Jack turns to him and says, well, we're in it together, you know?
Exactly. We're in it together. LeMay and his other generals and admirals are cursing him out when he leaves that tape recorder on and goes into another room.
This just is indicative of the despicable character of these events, but LeMay was actually in the autopsy room at Bethesda smoking a cigar.
He was.
Yes, he was.
He was.
Absolutely shameful. In fact, one of the medical techs, I think it was Jim Jenkins, was sent over to tell him that there was no, smoking wasn't permitted in the morgue, but when he approached him and saw who it was and read the name LeMay and saw the four stars, you know, he decided that maybe discretion was the better act, and didn't pursue it. But this is also shameful. There's stories about that autopsy you wouldn't believe, Jim, about how at first when the body, when they saw the body, they were apprehensive and worried that, like, he was going to sit up, you know, like he was going to get up off the table. But as it proceeded, and of course you're taking the man's body apart, as the dissection proceeded, they relaxed, and by the time it was over, I have had descriptions that it was a festival atmosphere there, that, you know, they were now relaxing, enjoying themselves. You'd think they were going to break out the champagne.
Yes, yes.
Truly, truly disgusting.
And it also emphasizes the degree to which Kennedy's assassination and the effort to understand it is not so much a figuring out of the who did it so much as realizing it's almost a consensus in terms of the attitude toward Kennedy among the people in power at that time. They just, for example, you were giving the example of his closest advisors, people that he trusted, like Hillsman and McGeorge Bundy, although
yes.
I'm sure he had questions about them. But these are people that simply thought they knew better. They simply thought, we know better than the president. He's got to move ahead on Vietnam. He's got to get more advisors. He's got to get the troops in there. We know better. We know better. It was a consensus that this man was wrong. And I'm not saying that all of these people were involved in the assassination. They obviously weren't. But when you have an atmosphere of such total consensus that this man is leading us to disaster in terms of the Cold War, then it's relatively easy for those who want to take it to the extreme of actually killing him, it's relatively easy for them to operate in that context.
Then you get the shameful remark by Alan Dulles many years after Jack's death, you know, and he's being interviewed and he's speaking of him contemptuously and saying he thought he was a god.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And of course, Dulles had a whole lot to do with the assassination, as did a lot of the parties, I think, that we've been talking about here. The chiefs, the Secret Service, we've discovered more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity. And, you know, there were just enough key players in the right positions to control what actually happened. And, of course, the Mafia wanted Jack out, but there have been some ridiculous books. I mean, if you look at something like Ultimate Sacrifice by Lamar Waldron and Tom, Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, it must just cause you great pain, Jim, because, I mean, I look at these books and I think, well, this is complete and utter rubbish. You know, the theme of this is that Jack was going to invade Cuba after he'd told the whole world he wasn't going to, that the Mafia had learned of his plan, that they took him out and then used the threat of revealing the plan to constrain Bobby from doing an investigation and to manage the affair, which is about as absurd as it could possibly be. Not only had Jack, you know, committed the United States to non-intervention in Cuba, if he had done anything like that, it would have so tattered the reputation of the United States and its moral standing. Not only that, but if the mob had wanted to kill, you know, while they had a motive to kill Jack, they would have waited until after he invaded Cuba so they could have regained control of the resorts and casinos in Havana where they were running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. The idea they would take him out in advance, knowing he's going to invade Cuba, is about as absurd a thesis as I can imagine. Even Robert McNamara, you know, when told of this theory of the case, said, well, you know, that would come as news to him because he knew nothing about any such plans. And mm-hmm. What appears to be the case is they found a contingency plan where the Pentagon has, you know, 10 different contingency plans for invading Samoa, for God's sake. I mean, this is ridiculous, wow. You know, and misinterpreted it and took it to be central and important when, in fact, it was peripheral and insignificant.
Well, we have to keep to the sources, and I think in all of these works of disinformation, if we examine carefully the sources, there are no sources other than the sources that killed JFK. If you find in any book on the Kennedy assassination that there are people that cannot be identified in large numbers or people who are from the Central Intelligence Agency coming as your major source, for example, James Jesus Angleton is the source of key books on the Kennedy assassination. Well, James Jesus Angleton was in charge of Lee Harvey Oswald. He's not going to be a good source for the Kennedy assassination, nor are any of the other so-called ex-CIA people who have retired. If you don't retire from the CIA, you remain in a different form, a CIA person. So unless you are somebody who's obviously making a break in a visible and public way from the CIA. So the sources of these are just disinformation sources and actually assassination sources in the sense that these are the people that carried out the assassination.
Yes.
They're not going to tell you the truth about what John Kennedy was doing in office.
Yes.
Or tell you the truth about the assassination. And for Alan Dulles to be investigating the Kennedy assassination, that's the Fox investigating the murder in the hen house. He's the number one suspect.
Once you understand these things, nothing could be more blatant. Stand by. We're going to be right back with my special guest, James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
Thank you. Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Stem cell research. Abortion. Cloning. Cloning. Evolution. Creation science. Intelligent design. These are hot-button issues today. Religion and science. Morality and government. Corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. You mentioned Lee Oswald, Jim, and of course, understanding Oswald's role here is rather important. As a Marine Corps officer, I used to supervise recruit training at the same recruit depot and rifle range where Oswald took his training. And I observed in relation to his marksmanship record that when he was a recruit in 1957, he fired a 221 out of 250, which is 50 points at five different distances, and well, three different distances, but five different combinations of distance and location, which is not bad shooting. That qualified him as a sharpshooter in the Marine Corps, where the three categories, marksman is the lowest, sharpshooter, and then expert above 220 to 250. I shot, 221 myself on occasion. But what was striking to me isn't only that in 1959 he barely qualified with a 191, which was probably a gift because at this point in time he had the reputation for getting a lot of Maggie's drawers, which is the white flag that's waved when you miss the target completely. And 191 would mean he was just barely qualifying, so he dropped 21 points in 2 years, which since marksmanship is a highly practiced, dependent activity, and we have no evidence at all that he was maintaining his marksmanship ability, there's no telling how bad a marksman he could have been by 1993. But what's most striking about his record is that in 1958 he didn't qualify at all. Now, one who's never, isn't acquainted with the Marine Corps might not realize it is a mandatory requirement that every Marine, from the lowest private to the highest ranking general, must qualify every year with a rifle.
So yeah. that Oswald didn't qualify in 58 is extremely telling. It means something extraordinary was going on. My opinion is that he had already been recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he was undergoing Russian language training at the school maintained by the military at Monterey in California. And that, of course, when he would he'd subsequently be stationed at Atsugi, our most highly classified base in Japan, the base from which the U-2 overflights were taking place. His pseudo-defection on a Sunday when it had no legal significance, all clearly feigned. He may have been taking them information about the altitude of these U-2 flights. The Russians knew it was taking place, but they didn't know, you know, they couldn't shoot it down. And then we have the Gary Francis Powers, you know, he comes out of the sky, doesn't take a cyanide tablet. Khrushchev accuses Eisenhower on the eve of what's going to be a summit meeting intended to reduce tensions that the U.S. is spying on the Russians. Eisenhower says, absolutely not, we're not doing it. And then Khrushchev is able to display not just parts of the plane, but the pilot himself, which, of course, completely reverses the trend and increases Cold War tensions instead of reducing them. He comes back to the United States, and he's not subjected to an interrogation as though he'd been a traitor to his country. He's even given money by a CIA front organization to relocate to New Orleans. And here you have this very interesting thing going on, which is he's being sheep-dipped or being given this new persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer, and he's giving out pamphlets for the Fair Play for Cuba committee, and in other ways, you know, making himself very conspicuous, even getting into a fight with some actual anti-Castro Cubans there who thought that he was on the other side, gets on television, all this kind of stuff. And eventually, of course, the claim is made that he's made these trips down to Mexico City, which you discussed, purportedly to get visas. And you know, whoever's down there is constantly making themselves very obnoxious, so nobody's going to forget who they are. But the CIA actually had both audio and video, and the guy who was down there didn't look like Oswald, and he didn't sound like Oswald. And it was clear that someone was impersonating him. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover actually put out a memorandum to his officers in charge of his stations that someone was impersonating Lee Oswald in Mexico City. And it seems to me, Jim, if that's all you knew about the assassination, that someone was impersonating Oswald in Mexico City, you'd understand it was a conspiracy, that it was a sham, that Oswald was set up, that he was a patsy.
Exactly. And there's the larger scenario of the JFK assassination, the scenario which means to scapegoat not simply Lee Harvey Oswald, but behind him, Cuba and the Soviet Union. Those trips to the consulates in Mexico City that are tape recorded and that are documented in every way by the CIA in advance of the assassination, those are designed, as we see from the way they are presented to Lyndon Johnson on Sunday after the assassination, those are designed to push the next administration into attacking Cuba and the Soviet Union for having been the instruments, those behind the instrument in the assassination, namely Lee Harvey Oswald. So its purpose is not simply and only to scapegoat Oswald, but more significantly to draw us as a nation into, quote, winning the Cold War by attacking those who are actually negotiating and prepared to negotiate with President Kennedy. So everything is being totally reversed by this scenario designed to implicate not only Oswald, but the communist enemies, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're getting a twofer or a threefer out of pinning the tail on Oswald. I mean, they've got him set up to be a leftist, a communist, pinko Castro sympathizer in the first place, and a solitary, you know, this lone, demented gunman. I mean, the fact is that the weapon that they planted on him, this Mannlicher Carcano, could not have fired the bullets that killed the president because it wasn't a high-velocity weapon, and yet the president was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets. About four or five of his co-workers observed him down around the first and second floor, before the assassination at 10 minutes to 12, at 12, at 12:15, as late as 12:25, when Carolyn Arnold, who was the executive secretary of the vice president, said she saw him in the lunchroom. There's this photograph, the Alton's photograph, during the assassination where he may even be on the front steps watching what's going on. And, of course, a motorcycle patrolman by the name of Marion Baker confronts him in the lunchroom within 90 seconds after the assassination. And as you mentioned in passing, I mean, he's drinking a Coke. So you get this fantastic scenario that if the government were right, then what has the assassin of the most powerful man in the world done? Well, he's raced across the warehouse steps, stashed his trusty man liquor Carcano down four flights of steps into the lunchroom for what? To have a Coke. So I say the commercial possibilities are endless here. You got Lee Oswald with his man liquor Carcano in one hand and his bottle of Coke in the other, saying things really do go better.
If we back up even a little bit further, say 3 weeks earlier to the attempt to assassinate John Kennedy in Chicago, we see precisely the same scenario going down as we do in Dallas, the only difference being that Lee Harvey Oswald isn't there, and you've got in Chicago a man named Thomas Arthur Valley, whose background is point by point very, very similar to Lee Harvey Oswald's. He's also had been, as you know, a Marine over in Japan at a CIA base, and he had been working with the Central Intelligence Agency, and he winds up in a job in a window overlooking a parade route for John F. Kennedy in the first week of November 1963. And had it not been for the cancellation at the very last possible moment of Kennedy's trip to Chicago in November the 2nd, we would not know anything today about Lee Harvey Oswald. We'd be talking about Thomas Arthur Valley as the because Thomas Arthur Valley was to have been the scapegoat in Chicago. And there we've got a rifle team, the same as in Dallas, and we've even got them located and identified in advance of that assassination attempt in Chicago, thanks especially to a Secret Service agent named Abraham Bolden, who I interviewed time after time to get exactly right his story of what went down in Chicago. So we know the whole scene 3 weeks, or at least intelligence agencies do, and the Secret Service in particular, who were, quote, investigating this attempt in Chicago. So if all the same things were being planned and plotted in Chicago, how come they happened in Dallas 3 weeks later? Well, obviously because the forces behind the scene cover up the Chicago attempt in order to let it all go down in Dallas in the same form. And the snipers are even allowed to go free without our even knowing their names to this day in terms of documentation. They're just let loose. And it may actually have been some of the same snipers who killed Kennedy in Dallas as who were prepared to kill him in Chicago, because the Secret Service let them all go. And we know all of this thanks to Abraham Bolden. But if you understand the Chicago scenario, the first week in November, you know exactly what's going to go down in Dallas. And we do know that scenario today, so we can see just how comprehensive and systematic the Kennedy assassination was. If we don't get him in Chicago, we get him in Dallas.
Yes, and that day they even had backup plans. If they didn't get him in Dealey Plaza, they were going to get him at the Trade Mart. And if they didn't get the Trade Mart, the worst fallback was they were going to take him out on Lyndon Johnson's own property, though obviously for all kinds of reasons that was the least desirable option. But the politics and the psychology of pinning the tail on Oswald is so brilliant, because you got this one man, lone, demented, when in fact it's a group, a very powerful group. You know, you got a powerless guy, and in fact they even try to finagle the explanation that he did it because he wanted to make himself have a sense of power or accomplishment, when in fact it's all these powerful forces arrayed from him that really are far removed politically from any views like those of attributed to Oswald. And of course, because of his association with Cuba, we're supposed to suppose that Castro and the Soviets were behind it. So that's to enrage the American people who are going to rise up and insist that the military crush Cuba, and who knows, maybe precipitate a war with the Soviets. It's even to this day surprising to me in a way that Lyndon was unwilling to go down that path. Maybe he simply realized that the risks were just too great.
Well, I think that he's a complicated individual, but he has enough rationality not to want to begin his presidency with a total nuclear war. he did not want to be the president of 3 to 5 days and then go down in history as a person who was involved in the worst criminal action in the history of the world. So I think Johnson was someone who then engaged in the Warren Commission in order to cover up the most extreme nature of the Kennedy assassination, that is, the intention of scapegoating the Cubans and the Soviets, and instead focusing entirely on Oswald, which is a contingency plan. If it had gone down the original way, it would have, of course, been a focus on a conspiracy involving the Soviet Union and Cuba. And so they have to cover up all of this obvious evidence that's false evidence created by the CIA. So Johnson had a very difficult dilemma. Either he had to confront the forces in his own government who were responsible for assassinating the president, which would then put him in a similar or analogous position, or he has to go to war with the Soviet Union and Cuba in the basis of the false evidence. So in order to avoid those two horns of the dilemma, he chooses the, quote, middle path of covering up absurdly all the evidence and saying through the Warren Commission that Lee Harvey Oswald did it in spite of such obvious evidence as we've been discussing on this program.
And, of course, Marina would later observe that Lee admired JFK and bore him no malice, which means that the guy that they fingered for the assassination had neither the motive nor the means nor the opportunity to take him out.
That's right. And we know from his draft of his own talk to a bunch of Jesuit seminarians at Spring Hill College, not far from where I'm talking today in Mobile, Alabama, that Lee Harvey Oswald was suggesting that there might very well be a conspiracy to take out the president, and that while he suggested it might be the U.S. Marines, he did so in such terms as to suggest much more clearly the Central Intelligence Agency. So in the one piece of evidence that we have from Oswald that summer, which is probably of his own doing, then created by the CIA, where he's talking toward the truth rather than toward setting up a scenario that's going to wind up implicating himself, he's not only expressing his sympathy with JFK, but he's also indicating that there is a conspiracy and it involves parts of our own government.
Just to compliment you on the meticulousness and thoroughness with which you have undertaken your research, I was, and I have learned something on almost every page of your book that I have read. It's really a fascinating experience, even after having spent as much, 15 years of my life on these matters. I'm learning so much from your book. And something that you did that I found rather convincing, I'd always been disposed to believe that in the Alchins that we actually were looking at Billy Lovelady. And when you talk about, I'd heard, of course, before about the reports that he was actually in a different part of the steps there. But the talk about the shirt and how Oswald had his shirt unbuttoned and he would tug at his T-shirt, so he tended to stretch it out. And you find multiple photographs where you have the stretch out of the T-shirt. And then we find it in the Alchins, too. To me, that's very persuasive evidence that, in fact, we have a photograph of Lee Oswald right on the steps of the book depository while the assassination is taking place.
Well, let me say something to you, Jim, at this point. I don't stop researching. After that book was published, I have continued to research. And I am questioning my conclusion on that matter, and I'm still researching the matter of whether that is Lee Harvey Oswald or Billy Lovelady. Well, and when I do a paperback edition of the book, I may reach a different conclusion. In fact, I probably will. So that's a relatively small point, whether he was actually in the doorway or up having lunch in the book depository. He definitely was not up there shooting the president. There's no way he could have been, and we know that much.
I think, as you have done over
all these years, we have to keep working at the research and get it more and more and more precise. I was convinced at one point that it was Oswald rather than Lovelady, and now I'm questioning that, and I will continue to work on that point.
Of course, Oliver believed it was Lovelady, but then he also believed that the Zapruder film was authentic. And that's very, very interesting, because the way you argued it to me was, you know, the most convincing argument I've heard about the identity of this disputed figure, this image on the stairs. Another aspect of this that I was impressed by had to do with your treatment of Rose Sheremy, who, of course, was former stripper and knew Jack Ruby and knew that he knew Oswald and even said that they'd had an intimate relationship of long standing. This is all terribly interesting stuff. Her death was very, very, I suppose, predictable in a way, because, you know, she was a relatively small player who knew too much, so they had to silence her. But the fact that the authorities, you know, didn't know whether to take her seriously or not, and then after the assassination realized, well, maybe they actually had someone here who did know what she was talking about. That was, I thought
and
you...
Rose, yeah, and I think Rose Sheremy is a good example of a witness who is easily belittled and attacked because she was a prostitute. She's at the lowest level in terms of respect that one gives a witness, and yet because of that very position that she's in, she sees the low life, she sees the people who are being brought in to carry out this assassination, and she has integrity, and she speaks up. And I respect enormously that woman, Rose Sheremy, because of her courage. And obviously she had faults, as did everybody in this story, including John Kennedy. But she had courage, and she had the courage to speak the truth, and she was a witness to the unspeakable, and she died as a consequence. She's, in that sense, you know, the term martyr means witness. The term martyr means a witness to the truth. That's the actual Greek term. So Rose Sheremy was such a courageous witness, and we have to respect her.
I think that's right. And, we have many witnesses to the association between Jack Ruby and Lee Oswald. Beverly Oliver, who was, of course, opposite the grassy knoll taking a film that was, taken by the FBI that she's never seen, has told me how she was singing at a nearby club, and she was only 17 years old, but went over to the carousel, and Jack Ruby called her over and said he wanted her to meet his friend Lee Oswald from the CIA. And Beverly adds, you know, that she didn't know what that meant then, and she still doesn't know what it meant today. Meaning, you know, what is this agency, this entity, the CIA? But we also have others, other women who worked at the club who have said the same thing. Ian Griggs, an English detective, a British detective, has published a book about, interviews with a lot of those who were working for Ruby, and many of them attested to the association between Lee Oswald and Jack Ruby.
Sure, and these are people who are discredited because, you know, they had any association with Ruby in the first place. Well, we're not going to learn anything unless we are willing to listen, and then it certainly sift through all of these stories. But the people who are in the low life of Dallas had insights to the assassination that the people who are at the high life of, for example, journalism in Washington, D.C. may not have.
I think that's absolutely right. We're going to take another break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. We'll be right back.
it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
You're listening to RevereRadio.net, the worldwide home of free speech, even when it's ugly. If you're enjoying this broadcast, become a member of Revere Media today. Annual membership is only $43.64 and includes a limited edition Revere Radio t-shirt, 8 bumper stickers courtesy of LibertyStickers.com, your very own free podcasting account with unlimited storage,
a $72 value.
Gain access to subscriber-only content on the website and forum. If you're a small business owner or webmaster, one free banner ad for a full month.
A $100 value.
A Revere Radio press pass to attend all the events and cover them live on your own show, blog, or podcast. Receive a weekly newsletter via email recapping the past week's content on Revere Media and all the top headlines of the week. Receive periodic text messages on your cell phone with the latest news in the world and the latest happenings at Revere Media. A value well over $200. All for just $43.64 per year.
But wait, there's more.
If you subscribe today, you don't have to listen to Rob Revere beg for donations on air anymore. This alone is priceless. Do yourself a favor and subscribe today at RevereRadio.net.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host of The Real Deal, with my special guest James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim, something I mentioned early on that I wanted to reiterate is how impressed I am with the thoroughness of your research and how you have been dealing with scholars like Vince Palomara, who is the world's leading expert on the Secret Service, David Lifton, who made some brilliant discoveries about the medical evidence very early on in his book, Best Evidence. Even persons who are as off of the chart as Bruce Campbell Adamson, who's done all this work on DeMoren's child, who appears to have been Oswald's handler in Dallas. I think that's quite remarkable.
Well, as you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of all these great researchers, and not least of whom is Jim Fetzer. And so it's your work and people like Vince Palomara, David Lifton, and of course Vince Landry and Marty Schatz, my friends. There are tens of thousands of great citizen researchers. Let's distinguish from government people right now. Citizen researchers who have on their own been doing this courageously for decades. I'm a latecomer, a very latecomer to all of this. And without all these great pioneer researchers and the work of people like you, I have no book to write.
Well, it's a masterpiece, Jim, and I'm just so gratified that you wrote this. I don't think I could find the words to tell you how important a book you've written. In a number of places, you talk about Edward Lansdale. A number of us think that he may well have been the coordinator of the assassination in Dealey Plaza. Of course, he was responsible for assassinations in many parts of the world. Here, of course, in part, he was being approached by JFK for representing him to the Diem brothers. And, you know, asking, in essence, whether Lansdale understood or Jack meant what Lansdale took him to mean, that if they weren't able to work things out, you know, through diplomacy and negotiation, would he go along with another approach if it were required? And Lansdale thought that he meant assassination and responded, "No, Mr. President, I couldn't do that. Diem is my friend." Which is, I think, an admirable response. Whether or not Jack was contemplating that, however, is a whole other matter, because I don't think there is really reason to believe that Jack was supportive of assassination as a mechanism for resolving issues. In fact, quite the contrary, and the whole theme of your book runs against it.
Well, Edward Lansdale's history in Vietnam in particular, and with the Central Intelligence Agency, is a very big reason to question anything he brings forward as a point against John Kennedy, or to accept on the face of it anything he says. And he doesn't say much. He very clearly avoids the subject of the assassination in his writings and in his speech. So Edward Lansdale is not a trustworthy person on the assassination of JFK. I have a mutual friend with Edward Lansdale who's pretty well known, Daniel Ellsberg. And Daniel Ellsberg, who is, as you know, was a critic in many severe ways of the U.S. government, continues to be so to this day. Nevertheless, Edward Lansdale was so good at dissimulating that Dan Ellsberg, even though he was very, very close to him in Vietnam in the years immediately following the Kennedy assassination, he never once knew that the extent to which Lansdale was supervising operations down in Cuba during a period of JFK's presidency. And Lansdale was extremely circumspect and extremely good at dissimulation and not letting even his closest friends, among whom Ellsberg counted himself, he wouldn't let them know what was really going on.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, even your notes, you know, you have some very important notes. One toward the end, of course, is talking about Jackie's words to Anastasis Mykoyan, the Soviet diplomat.
Yes.
We actually, you know, talked briefly about this before, but where McGeorge Bundy is actually changing Jackie's original letter, to me, is profoundly disturbing. In fact, I know a scholar, a recent scholar of the JFK case, who believes that Bundy was a disloyal to Jack in many different ways. And this is a particularly stunning illustration, it seems to me.
If we get to the details of things, we begin to see the larger picture. And the reason all those notes are there is so that people can not only see the sources of everything that's in the larger text of the book, but also so that they can see the smaller stories, because each of these smaller stories, you're talking about one now about Jacqueline Kennedy trying to write to Khrushchev and actually having her letters censored in transit by McGeorge Bundy, all of these smaller stories give us an insight into the larger story. And Edward Lansdale is another case in all of his maneuvering behind the scenes during Diem's years in power in Vietnam. These smaller stories build up, and so we can see the larger story. And I wanted to mention a very big part of the larger story before we lose time here. I know this is our last segment, and that is the American University Address, which
I was going to compliment you, by the way, Jim, for including it. When I co-authored a book on the death of Paul Wellstone, My co-author and I included his speech opposing the war in Iraq, which appears to have been an immediate contributing factor to his to his death, which appears to have been an assassination. And I thought it was so appropriate that you should include as an appendix his commencement speech at American University on the 10th of June, 1963.
Yes, and it's very intentional that the first thing the reader comes across as the book ends is really the centerpiece of the book, and that is the American University address, in which JFK says, in his own words, and in his, you know, everybody attributes this to Sorensen. Well, Kennedy tells Sorensen what to write. You know, a speechwriter on John Kennedy doesn't just go off and write anything he wants. Kennedy gave very specific orders to Sorensen what he wanted in that speech. And much of that speech was created by a man named Norman Cousins, who was Kennedy's chief advisor when it came to his relationship with Khrushchev, and another intermediary over in Rome named Pope John the 23rd. There are some amazing things going on beneath the surface during these years. But in the case of the American University address, Kennedy is in effect saying, "I want to end the Cold War," and he does so in the most eloquent speech of his, not only his presidency, but of his life. And to this day, we as American citizens don't know that speech. Everybody knows elements of his inaugural address, but his far more important speech, the one that got him killed, the one that he spoke on June 10, 1963 to the graduating class at American University, we don't know that. It's almost as if his microphone was turned off, as it was in effect by the national media. He says in that speech that he is wanting us as a people to see, first of all, the suffering and the death of the Russian people, our so-called enemies, and to understand the Cold War from their standpoint, and to see the terrible destruction and devastation of their nation at the end of the Second World War, when they and we were allies. And then the core of his speech is engaged in an analysis of not the question in those days, which you and I can remember as having been, you know, and those who are some of the older members of this radio audience, the main question in those days was always, to anybody who tried to negotiate peace, what about the Russians? You can't trust the Russians. What about the Russians? In the core of that American University address, Kennedy turns that speech totally, that question totally around. He says, what about us? What about the Americans? You know, it's not a question simply of blaming everything on the Russians. We have to address the reasons why we're not willing to negotiate, why we're not willing to disarm, and then he goes into his initiative of saying that he's not going to test in the atmosphere another nuclear weapon unless somebody else were to do so. That's a unilateral initiative of stopping testing by the United States and then trying to negotiate a test ban treaty with the enemy, and even says, we're not going to do that here in Washington. We're going to go to the capital of the enemy, Moscow, and try to negotiate it there. 6 weeks after that statement, he's done it. He's done it personally. He's in effect the direct negotiator with Khrushchev and with the Russians. Avril Harriman, who's the nominal guy who goes over to Moscow, he's on the phone constantly with Kennedy, and Kennedy is making an end run around all his military advisors, all of whom are opposed to that treaty. So Kennedy is, in effect, moving into an end to the Cold War by negotiating that treaty and by his making the statement in the American University address, which Nikita Khrushchev says is the greatest speech made by any American president since Franklin Roosevelt. That's the turning point, and that is, in terms of intentionality and words, why JFK gets killed. The American University address.
I'll read a few short paragraphs.
Please do.
Both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours, and even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interests. So, let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
Amen. As we say down here in the South at the end of a sermon, and this is a good sermon. This is a sermon for peace. It is one addressed to all of us, and it's one that we weren't given the opportunity to hear even to this day. You read a book about JFK, and to this day you will find only a line or two, if that, about the American University Address. This bears the same relationship to JFK's assassination as the Riverside Church Address of April 4, 1967 bears to Martin Luther King's assassination 1 year to the day afterwards. Martin Luther King was coming out against the Vietnam War in his Riverside Church Address, his greatest speech. And JFK, in his greatest speech at American University address, his American University Address, he's coming out against the Cold War. This is the reason for the assassination. And in the very beginning of that speech where he says, "What kind of peace do I mean? What kind of peace do we seek?" He answers and says, "Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war." Well, a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war is exactly what the Cold War state wants, and exactly what the military-industrial complex was totally dependent on, a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. So Kennedy, by rejecting that in the very opening of his speech, he's resisting what President Eisenhower had identified in the closing moments of his presidency as the military-industrial complex. Kennedy is standing against what Eisenhower only had the courage, and thank goodness he had the courage in the closing hours to identify it. Kennedy is standing against it in his American University Address.
Well, you make so many powerful points, because this speech was alarming to the CIA, to the Joint Chiefs, to the whole military-industrial complex, which felt it was being threatened to its very core. I mean, the armaments industry, the whole war industry, makes its money off of engagements that bring about death and destruction around the world. And for someone to speak up and to say that he does not seek a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war, not a peace of the grave or the security of the slave, a genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, That's not their theme, Jim. You put it so well, so clearly. I think that this book is going to stand as a monument to exactly what happened, the perfidy, the betrayal of the ideals of this nation by its own military-industrial complex. It's a stunning indictment.
The speech that we're talking about now has a kind of backdrop that's extremely important, too. From the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis until Kennedy's assassination, he and Khrushchev are on a parallel path. They're in a sense, secret allies, and they're more closely related to each other in their overall purpose than either is to his own national security state. And they have a very unlikely ally in the midst of them, and that is a man named Pope John the 23rd over there in Rome, who had made an appeal in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis for a moving back by both leaders. And it was appeal done in secret negotiations with them through a man who was an intermediary between them named Felix Morleone, whom I actually worked for in Rome, Italy, a year later. So I knew the story at that time. But Pope John the 23rd was extremely influential on Nikita Khrushchev, and he wrote John the 23rd wrote in the closing moments of his life when he was dying of cancer an important statement called Peace on Earth, Pacem in Terris, a formal papal encyclical addressed to the entire world. And in that, there is the theme of mutual trust between nuclear enemies rather than equality of arms as the basis of peace, mutual trust. And that is precisely what he is encouraging through his own intermediary, Norman Cousins, the same guy who is Kennedy's key advisor in all of this. Norman Cousins is shuttling between Kennedy and John the 23rd and Nikita Khrushchev, and both Khrushchev and Kennedy are being encouraged in their steps of mutual trust by this man over in Rome, who is supposed to be diametrically opposed to Khrushchev because one's a Christian leader and the other is an atheist leader. On the contrary, again, this is against all the public story and the one that we're given even to this day. Khrushchev is being given important statements by John the 23rd secretly, and he's even being given a papal medallion, which he proudly displays to his communist cohorts. The whole thing is totally against what we think has to be between enemies. So this is the story beneath the story, that enemies are coming to trust one another, and that trust is the basis for peace on earth. And John Kennedy articulates all that in his American University address.
Something that I find so striking about your book is it's not only, you know, an exposure of the corruption and the deceit and the deception of the national security state, but also this magnificent journey of this human being from toward a broader understanding and transcendent goals of bringing an enduring peace to the world, and the immensity of the struggle and the enormity of the forces that are allied against him.
Yes, that's the unspeakable, the enormity of the forces allied against John F. Kennedy. And I got that term from a man named Thomas Merton, a monk, a Trappist monk living in a monastery in Kentucky, in the hills of Kentucky, a man whom I knew, living at the Abbey of Gethsemane. He's, in a sense, the spiritual advisor in the writing of this book, although he died himself in 1968. But he was a friend, and he's written monumental books and works, including a book called Raids on the Unspeakable. The unspeakable is the kind of evil that goes, it's where we don't want to go. Nobody wants to go deeply enough into the Kennedy assassination to see the truth. It's the kind of unspeakable evil that the CIA would call plausible deniability rather than a simple lie, but that involves such an enormity of deception and of killing that we don't want to go there. It's the unspeakable. And Thomas Merton, even though he was a monk who didn't have any television or newspaper access, he wrote and corresponded with people, including Ethel Kennedy and people in various stages and parts of the government. He could see things that people couldn't see who were in the Beltway. So the unspeakable is where we have to go today, as well as in that day, in order to see the truth of what of the courage that John F. Kennedy had in standing against the military-industrial complex and even his closest advisors.
Once you begin to appreciate the quality of the man, you realize how the vast majority of politicians pale by comparison. They are such mediocrities and in intellectual midgets compared to this man who is truly ahead of his time. And in fact, I mean, the Joint Chiefs couldn't begin to understand the worldview that John Kennedy represented. They had no comprehension. These were very small minds, very pedestrian, very uninspired by the great truths that the world has ever known. And Jack was so completely their opposite. It's hardly surprising that they couldn't have a genuine, cordial, amicable relationship, that their conflict would be inevitable, and that they could exercise the power they possessed to destroy the man permanently.
Yes, and you suggest here, Jim, a very, very critical point, which is the second part of the subtitle of this book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Why it matters. This is not a story about something that happened 46 years ago. This is a story about something that is happening right now, right now. Because if the current president should have the courage to turn, as John Kennedy did, toward peace, he faces precisely the same forces as John F. Kennedy did, and precisely the same consequence as John F. Kennedy did. So unless we begin to understand the story of what happened to John Kennedy, we are not aware of what is happening right now, today, in the White House, and of the importance and the significance of the turn of Kennedy, which has to be the turn of the current president. If there isn't that turn, we're going to be destroyed by a violence that goes beyond our imagination. But if the president does turn toward peace, as he must, then he faces the same dangers. So it's up to us. It's not simply up to Barack Obama. It's up to us to understand the Kennedy story and to make sure that, on the one hand, it does get repeated in the sense of the current president turning by our pushing him to turn in that direction, and secondly, that it doesn't have the same consequence because we are so much aware of what happened the first time around and get out ahead of that president and say, this must happen again in the sense of turning toward peace, but it must not happen again in the sense of our being so blind and so impervious to these forces that we allow them to take down another presidency.
I offer my unqualified endorsement of this book if you want to understand why he died and why it matters, which continues to this very day. You must read JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show with me. It's been a privilege.
Thank you for the privilege of being with you, Jim, and for all the great work you have done on the JFK assassination.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking you all for listening.
Far away, now it looks as though they're here to stay.